today on Rocking the Suburbs.
You know how it is with sibling harmonies. There's nothing like it.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this episode of our music podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in. We got a special three-day series coming for you. It's the mini week that is headed your way, and I hope you're going to enjoy it. Before I talk about that, though, I want to remind everybody who's listening that it is March. It's a new month, so you want to make sure you're noting down your February 2025 new music picks. That'll be coming up later in the month. We'll give you a date for the beginning of that. Probably going to look to start that sometime around the 17th or 18th of this month. So make sure you start thinking about that. Note down your picks and make your calls. Make your voice files. Get ready. Get ready. In the meantime, I want everyone to continue to vote in the 80s Madness album countdown poll. We're at the second round. The voting has begun. It's a ton of fun. And even if nobody likes the albums in the host quadrant, we're still having a good time with it. And heading for some epic clashes and some epic clashes in this second round as well. So thank you for doing that. Just go to Facebook.com/suburbspod and you can find all the votes you need right over there. And there's also information if you go to suburbspod.com and click on 80s album madness. Just check that out. There's a banner and you can get a whole spreadsheet as it's updated if you're not updating your own bracket by hand like I am. All right. With that out of the way, I want to introduce this mini run of episodes, this little series. It is having to do with the music of the Bee Gees pre-disco, before they put on the white suits and sang in Saturday Night Fever and were worldwide superstars. Before that, they had quite a long career. And if you're not familiar, you're going to be. And I want to thank, from the bottom of my shoes to the tip of my balding head, Paul Hayden out there in Wilmette, Illinois, who did a lot of research, put together an outline. He has read a couple of books on the Bee Gees. He's got a lot of Bee Gees music. He's a fan, and that's where we're coming from. Him and I sat down on a weekend and recorded these episodes, and they're ready to go for you now. So we're going to start off, and the first thing you're going to hear right here is Paul discussing why we chose the topic of the Bee Gees. Take it away, Paul.
All right, so why the Bee Gees? In my opinion, they created a vast catalog of pop songs that have stood the test of time, sound great today. I think Barry Gibb is one of the best melodists of our time. His songs just, they're earworms, and consistently doing it for a number of years is pretty remarkable. And you know, I want to get away from the concept of, you know, they are just more than just teeth, chest hair, and medallions. They are serious songwriters, musicians, and have created quite a catalog over their years together.
I love that line right there. More than just teeth, chest hair, and medallions. I think we have to use that throughout Bee Gees week. Here on Rockin' the Suburbs. before we jump into the band's history, Paul, let me just ask you real quick. What was your first introduction to the Bee Gees? Was it like me that it was the big hits, Saturday Night Fever and those kind of songs?
It was Nights on Broadway and Jive Talkin'. See, when I started listening to AM radio religiously, it was 1973, and this was the year after How Can You Mend a Broken Heart went to number one, and My wife, who's has older sisters and is a little bit older than I am, they were common household name. Bee Gees, everybody knew them. But I, in 1973, just getting started, had no concept, never heard of them. But then 1975, Main Course comes out, and if you were listening to the radio in 1975, you could not avoid Jive Talkin' and Nights on Broadway. So that was my introduction, and stayed with them through probably 78. And then I got into other things that were not sounding anything like the Bee Gees and kind of put them aside. How about yourself?
Almost exactly the same. Really the same. Saturday Night Fever. When that came out, the album was such a big, at least, from my junior high perspective, it was a big social thing too. Like everybody had Saturday Night Fever. You would go over to someone's house and they would put on Saturday Night Fever. So, it was almost exactly the same. And I think it's really interesting that, Jive Talkin' and Nights on Broadway are kind of where we'll close the loop on this week, which is kind of cool. So we're going to learn about all that stuff beforehand. So Paul, talk a little bit about the Bee Gees background. I didn't know anything about this, and so I started doing a little prep. But I find their upbringing and how they grew up really fascinating.
It is, and it tells a lot about how they developed musically over the years. They were born, Barry is the second in the family. He was born in 1946, and then his twin brothers, Robin and Morris, were born in 1949. And they were born on the Isle of Man, and their father, Hugh, was a big band leader. And by 1955, that sound was kind of on the way out. And he went from having a really steady gig to kind of scrambling to find work. He wanted his wife to stay home and raise, at the time, their four children. So he just started scrambling. And in the meantime, by 1957, their sister Leslie brought home a 45 by the Everly Brothers. And she played it, and the brothers just, it was like they knew. This is our future. The way they harmonized, and the Bee Gees, I think at that time it kind of played around with music, but they kind of felt like this was a sign that this is what they need to do, because you know how it is with sibling harmonies. There's nothing like it.
Right, right.
Whether it's the Louvin brothers, the Everly brothers, there's something otherworldly about it. So once they heard that, they started their first band, the Rattlesnakes, and just played the covers of the day. And in the meantime, with their father having trouble finding work, they had to split up the family. And Barry went to go live with someone on one of their parents' side, and Robin and Morris went to live with another parent's relatives. And so they were subject to new schools, were not able to maintain a lot of friendships, got into a bit of trouble. And at some point in 1958, they were arrested for, I think they lit a fire somewhere. I'm not sure about that. But they lit a fire, and the policeman said, this isn't the first time. And they told the parents that they're one arrest away from reform school. So you can't find work. Their mother, I think their aunt said, "Oh, there's this great gig. You'd spend £10 and you can take a ship to Australia, start a new life." The ads all show this sunny weather, beaches, and the Gibb family said, "That sounds like a pretty good idea." So they get on the ship, and I think it took 2, 3 months to get down there from England to Australia. What was good about this time was that the brothers grew closer. They practiced their singing, and you've got a ship full of people that have nothing to do. And hey, let's go listen to the three brothers sing and entertain us. So they got a lot of
Amazing.
good practice
Amazing.
that way. And so by the time they get down there to Australia, they work on their act. They play wherever they can go. Racetracks, shopping center openings, talent shows, variety shows, so wherever we'll have them, they'll do it. And they started getting pretty good. And 1959, there's a racetrack owner whose name is Bill Good with an E, who had heard the brothers play. He introduced them to a man called Bill Gates, not the Microsoft guy. He was the number one DJ in Queensland at the time. And they recorded six songs, and that's how they originally became the Bee Gees, because it was Barry Gibb, Bill Good, and Bill Gates. It's like, what a coincidence. Let's call ourselves the Bee Gees. So it was B,
Amazing.
just the letters B and G, and then later on they extended it out and named themselves after the brothers Gibb. But that was how they first got their name, which I did not know until I read this book. So I should mention the source of all knowledge, this book, The Story of the Bee Gees, Children of the World by Bob Stanley, is where I got a lot of my
That looks great.
information. It's a really
Okay.
easy book to
Okay.
read. He's a big fan, so it's recommended.
I love the idea, and I was reading about this a little bit too, that they have a kind of racing in Australia called speedway, which I guess is kind of like dirt track racing. So I just love the idea of the BJs out there singing between the races. Like, that's too funny to me. And the other thing I didn't know was that there was a sister. I never knew that they had an older sister in the family, and I found that to be really interesting too. And it's so, as you just pointed out, I didn't know about the Everly Brothers record either. So there you go. That's family magic right there.
Family magic, right. And
Yeah.
also at the time, baby brother Andy had just been born. So
Ah.
he's not going to be part of our story, but he was the last Gibb, I believe. And he was just an infant when they took the ship down from England to Australia. Yeah, four of them, five kids. And at this point, I think Hugh, the father, realized that he's got something in his Barry and Morris and Robin, that they could do something, and he's going to put his energy towards managing them, getting them gigs, because they're young, they're underage, so they can't really play clubs, bars,
Right, right.
whatever. But he was able to sneak them in at one point, just to give them a taste of what it would be like to sing in front of a like an adult audience. I don't remember the circumstances here, but when they did it, the kids, they did great. They won them over, and it just furthered that desire, that hunger to make it big in the music world. Then we get to kind of the early 60s, and they start to hear, the Beatles starting out, the Beach Boys. Glen Campbell was a big influence. Barry's a big country music fan and had written songs in that vein, but never really, I mean, you never really hear that in their big songs, but it was always there. So they're picking up on the vibe of the music of the time. We kind of jump forward to 1966, where they released a song called Spicks and Specks. It was written by Barry, who was 19 at the time. Robin and Morris are 16. Made it all the way to number three on the Sydney charts.
Where is the sun that shone on my head? The sun in my life, it is dead, it is dead. Where is the light that would play in my streets? And where are the friends I could meet? I could meet. Where are the girls I left far behind? the sticks and the spades of the girls on my mind. Where is the sun that shone on my head? The sun in my life, it is dead, it is dead. Where are the girls that I left far behind? The sticks and the sticks of the girls on my mind. Where are the girls I left far behind? The sticks and the sticks of the girls on my mind. Where is the girl I love all along? The girl that I love, she is gone, she is gone.
So now he was, now he's thinking, okay, I think I can do something with this. So he does a crazy thing on November 25th, 1966. He writes a letter to Brian Epstein at NEMS. It says, Bee Gees are planning a trip to London and we need representation. Here's some acetates, some of the singles they've released. And he added that Barry was considered the top songwriter in Australia. And he figured he had nothing to lose. And it turned out to be the best career move he ever made.
I find this part amazing, and I did not know this, but imagine, Paul, how many burgeoning musicians, right, may have done the same thing, right? May have written a letter to the guy who was the manager of the Beatles and said, I got a group for you. So the fact that he actually, you know, number one, even listened to it, and number two, found it to be worthwhile, I think is incredible.
It is. And the song is a really good song. Spicks and Specks is really, you can kind of see the seed of where they would end up. And for him to be writing that at 19, you know, was pretty incredible. He
really incredible. Yeah.
It's got those themes that they would go back to over and over. You know, they very strong melodies, but the lyrics are a little on the bleak side. And that, I think, reflects their upbringing, their lack of, you know, close friendships, things like that they carried with them. And but it's kind of cool. I mean, that's my favorite kind of music, is the kind of the really sweet melody with the really dark lyrical side. I mean, that's a great trick.
Absolutely love it too.
All right, so now they're in London. And
so back to London after, what, 4 or 5 years in Australia or whatever it was. That's incredible, too.
Right. They took the ship back. So they're getting used to riding ships. And they, again, entertain their guests, their passengers, and were quite seasoned at this point. So they're in London. It's February of 1967. And their mother gets a phone call from a guy called Stickweed. And she writes it down, tells Hugh, hey, you call this guy? And turns out to be Robert Stigwood of RSO. And he was a talent agent. His company had merged with NEMS the month before. And he's looking for bands. Rock and roll is big. He's looking for a pop band, rock band to help him make some money. And he... because Brian Epstein had his hands full with his other band, the Beatles, he asked Stigwood to you know, represent them. He heard something in them, and as did Robert Stigwood. So they met. They agreed to a contract with Polydor, who at the time was a bit of a minor player in the pop world, and they were looking for bands.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like when Nirvana hit in the 90s, every label wanted to have that grunge band or whatever it was. They had to get their hands in the pot, in the pie. And so some things never change, I guess. But anyway, they go to Polydor Studios to record their first album. Songs, most of them, been written in the last year by Barry, and there's a power outage. So the band decides to get out of the studio, sit in a stairwell, and just start tooling around, and they just kind of riffed on a few things, and all of a sudden Barry had starts singing New York Mining Disaster 1941. In the event of something happening to me, there's something I would like you all to see.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. I keep straining my ears to hear a sound. Maybe someone is digging underground. Or have they given up and all gone home to bed, thinking those who once existed must be dead? Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide, Mr. Jones. In the event of something happening to me.
This was based on a Welsh mining disaster. I think it was in the 50s. But he had it in his head. And when they recorded it, and the echo that was generated by this stairwell, like, they knew they had it. They knew they had a good song.
It's amazing. Amazing.
It is a incredible song.
And the fact that it came about that way too, I just find so fascinating.
I mean, it's usually like the mistakes, the things you don't plan end up being the stuff that lasts, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, who knows how that song would have sounded had the power not gone out that day. I don't know.
Exactly. That's amazing to think about too. Where would it have all gone?
It's March of 1967 and the Stax Volt Tour hits London, and Barry gets to meet Otis Redding, who he's a big fan of. And they had a great meeting, whatever you want to call it, and he decided that the song To Love Somebody, which he had more or less finished, he wanted to give it to Otis. He thought it'd be a great match.
Yes.
But sadly, maybe a couple months later, was it? Plane crash. So what could have been? I bet it would have been phenomenal.
Unbelievable. I was thinking about that a lot this week as I was preparing for these episodes and listening to this early Bee Gees music. And I just can almost hear it, you know, in your head. You really can.
Kind of light that never shone on me. I want my life to be live with you, live with you. There's a way, everybody said, to do each and every little thing. To love somebody the way I love you. In my parade, I see.
I'm a man. Can't you see what I am? I live and I breathe for you. But what good does it do if I ain't?
So it didn't go that way, but it became, I don't know, I think it became somewhat of a standard. We were talking about covers earlier. I believe Janis Joplin and Flying Burrito Brothers.
Flying Burrito Brothers, yeah.
Did a version of it. So clearly Barry's name is getting out there as a songwriter. And their album comes out, Bee Gees first, on July 14th of 67. And the next single was Holiday, which... it's a really unusual song. It's got Robin singing lead, and he has a bit of a warble that I guess it could rub people the wrong way. I think it's incredible. But the lyrics in this one are really unusual. And Bob Stanley in the book says it's like he's using words intentionally incorrectly. I mean, they kind of had their own, you know, going again back to not having a lot of close friendships, not doing great at school. It's almost like they made up their own language, because a lot of their songs are very, like, if you were to scan them, you'd like, wait, that doesn't make sense. And if you listen to Holiday, it's like, it doesn't scan, but it creates a really vivid picture of what he's trying to, you know, convey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And Robin, his voice just on its own, you know, he's never actually singing about sunny days, you know.
When I first put together, I put together a playlist to sort of prep for this, and I don't know, I think I did it in semi-chronological order, New York Mining Disaster, Spicks and Specs was on there, and then I think fourth or fifth was Holiday. And that was the first one where I was actually over organizing some music, some albums, cleaning up when this came on, and I was like, wait a minute, what is this one? And I immediately had to go and look at the playlist to see what it was, because it really catches your, it almost comes on, you know, like the edges are blurring around everywhere, you know, and it really, really hooks you in.
Ooh, you're a holiday. Such a holiday. Ooh, you're a holiday. Such a holiday. It's something I think's worthwhile if the puppet makes you smile. If not, then you're throwing stones, throwing stones, throwing stones. Oh, it's a funny game. Don't believe that it's all the same. Can't think what I've just said. Put the soft pillow on my head. Millions of eyes can't see. Yet why am I so blind when the sun? Is mean, it's unkind, it's unkind. Deep, 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 deep.
I was so struck by how even these early songs don't sound dated in any way to me. You know, this could be in some ways a weird indie rock band in their basement in 2025, you know, who are really into old pop records trying to create something new. It's fascinating to me that they sound so fresh.
It is. I don't know what the secret sauce is, but I think they had a really good ear for arrangements. They would hire...
Yeah.
Really good string arrangers, and they just kind of knew what would fit the song best. And, you know, it could be minimal, like Holiday's a pretty minimal song.
It is.
And but yet, like you said, it just grabs you right away. Like the melody and just the way he sings it and the images, it's just like, whoa.
Really amazing. And then you go and look at the timings of all these songs, and they're all under 3 minutes. Like, they created these little, you know, sequenced them out just so. And it wasn't until a little bit later on till they, you know, started creating longer stuff. But man, these are some really incredible records.
Yeah, the economy and just knowing when to just say, okay, we've got enough. We've got the song. We don't need to add anything to it.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah.
So yeah, good point. They get it done in under 3 minutes.
That earns big points from my end. I love songs that are under 3 minutes.
Me and you both, Patrick. I mean, that's under three. That's the magic number. Kind of the really sweet melody with the really dark lyrical side. I mean, that's a great trick.